There are 16 companies that he gives money to, 16 media companies, and of course he's one of those people who now wants to decide what everybody else in the world should be eating. We are joined by the wonderful Matthew Errett, who is a wonderful historian. Matthew, welcome to the show. How are you?
Hey, Warren, I'm doing well. Thank you for having me.
And Mr. Slaughter's back with us after I've been holding the fort for the last 10, 15 minutes. Matthew has just joined
My
us late.
apologies. Hi, Matthew. How are you? Good to see you
Hey,
again.
Lee. Good seeing you again.
It is lovely to have you here, Matthew. We were just talking about Bill. We just finished up on Bill Gates before we went on, and we were just finishing up the last bit of the news. I was just going to mention a story, and I'd like your thoughts on this because Nilis is one of these people who very much likes to talk about old history and stuff like this. Can you explain to me, Matthew? We have here in Great Britain, we have a party called the Workers' Party of Great Britain, which is very much for the, shall we say, the Muslim community. Now, they went to, we're having a general election here, and the Workers' Party of Great Britain, quite rightly, went to the local mosque and said, could we please have your support for the Workers' Party of Great Britain? We are horrified by what's happening in Gaza. And the local mosque turned around and said that we are supporting the Labour candidate, and that is that, and we're having nothing further to do with you. Now, the Labour candidate is a massive friend of Israel, is a huge fan of Zionism, and obviously he's not only taken £400,000 from the Chinese spy, he's also been on many trips to Israel. Can you explain why a local mosque would be supporting a friend of Israel?
Oh, that's a juicy question. I didn't anticipate that. And I'm learning this afresh from you here for the first time. I did not know about this particular absurd case study, but of course I've got my hypotheses.
We'd be interested to hear it because we're baffled.
Well, I mean, look, I think it helps for me to look at everything from a bit of a historical standpoint. And that informs the context in which I try to situate a lot of paradoxes that appear to exist in my current age. Like, for example, the strange, weird connection between Azov right-wing neo-Nazi revivalist militia groups in Ukraine, who are highly embedded and protected by the Ukrainian government, that have been supported for a very long time by foreign intelligence agencies, armed, weaponized, instrumentalized. And they're openly pro-Bandera. They
Yes.
have all sorts of Nazi memorabilia, swastikas, and yet there's some strange overlaps with the Israeli Defense Forces and
Yes.
Israeli intelligence at the same time, where there's this weird collusion on a certain level between people who you would think Nazis and Jews should typically not get along very well, and yet in these cases they do. And so you're like, there's all these anomalies. And so for me, again, from a historical standpoint, I tend to approach things from the I try to look at history from a recognition of the causal existence of intelligence agencies that operate very much in connection with a private central banking structure with
Yes.
outlets like Wall Street and in a variety of countries that utilize control over finance, but also control over the bureaucracies of various governments as much as possible, the military bureaucracies, academia, think tanks. The whole full spectrum, aka deep state, right? So that's not a new thing. It didn't emerge out of thin air. It's been there for, I would say, all of human history, takes on different forms. And when you look at the very creation of Israel itself, it wouldn't have come into being were it not for things like the Balfour Accords that didn't just have Lord Balfour, but three other authors to draft that Balfour Accord declaration that created the State of Israel out of British Mandate Palestine, of which we have Lord Milner, who
Yes.
contributed to that, somebody
Yes.
who was himself also anti-Semitic, as was Lord Balfour himself, who believed in a
Yeah.
inferiority, an ontological inferiority to Jews. And Lloyd George was among that grouping as well, who also leaned very much pro-fascist. Lloyd George was even saying to Hitler, "I'll be your Nazi prime minister," when he had his
Yes.
second attempt to run for office again in the 30s. It wasn't just Oswald Mosley or Neville Chamberlain. But these were the guys playing a key role in formulating the Balfour Accords, who were pro-fascist anti-Semites who cared so much about establishing a state of Israel. And you're like, well, that appears to be contradictory, unless you kind of get how the game is being played from a top-down standpoint, and then you could start seeing how all sorts of groups have been artificially created that don't really represent Judaism or Islam or Christianity, but who have been weaponized versions, like we have with Wahhabite Islam, that
Zionism
only exists because of British intelligence and American intelligence later on providing weapons and logistical support to creating a radicalization of Islamic young men who do more killing of other Islamic people than they do even Christians or Jews. There's a reason why ISIS has done more work killing other Muslims than they have ever attacking. I don't think they have ever really attacked Israel. So it's like, then you start seeing how, okay, these are not naturally occurring phenomenon. These are weaponized versions wearing skin suits of Islam, but not, it is not Islam. And this is not Judaism. And this is not Christianity that we're seeing, though those intelligence agencies managing it would like us to believe otherwise. So that's how I would approach that particular question from context, not knowing anything about the details of what you've specified there.
So if we then layer in Zionism, because people think Zionism is just Judaism, but it's very akin to Nazism. And there are Christian Zionists, Jewish Zionists, and there are Muslim Zionists, as in the House of Saud. So how do you see that playing into that mix? Because deals get done in politics, and deals get done not necessarily for this election, which this mosque may be looking at, but get done for down the road some days, months, years, decades.
You guys ask really wonderful, rich questions. I got to say, like, these are good. It's a great point. I have a friend who lives in Syria. She's a British journalist named Vanessa Beely, and she was informing me. She's done some great history work, and she was informing me that in her research, that in the late 19th century, early 20th century, amongst the majority of the Jewish community living in Europe and in North America, political Zionism, as it was being sold around the Herzl networks and other networks, to try to convince the Jews that it's your destiny to like leave your European homelands and go live in the desert, that was being treated as just another variation of an anti-Semitic cult. So it was not accepted or embraced by most Jews during the times of the 1890s as being a legitimate representation of Judaism. You had like the majority, I think, were, especially in Europe, were like the Reform Jews following the currents of Moses Mendelssohn, Shalom Aleichem, who did Fiddler on the Roof. That really just, you know, saw that their being Jewish was not based on some blood or soil cult, or like reconstructing Solomon's temple, or being the chosen people to be above somehow the other people of the world who are not Jewish. They were of the view that, no, if you're going to be the chosen people, it means you have to be the obligation to be the most moral people as exemplars, not to be better genetically or something.
Nilus wants to ask you a question. We have on this show, Matthew, we have people who might want to pop up and ask a question. Nilus would like to ask something. Nilus?
It's just an observation. I've heard that the mosques in England and the UK are financed from Saudi Arabia, and also their imams are chosen from Saudi Arabia. And I think that is true, but... I don't know if there's any confirmation about that.
Matthew, your thoughts on that? They're being funded by Saudi Arabia. We have before. We've seen Saudi Arabia doing all sorts of bits and pieces, money going through banks in Saudi Arabia that are ending up in Jewish hands. Your thoughts on this?
Okay, so from my analysis so far, and it's a bit of a bigger question that's being pressed upon, Saudi Arabia per se was very useful, as at the time in the 1970s especially, was Pakistan, was a big one in serving as U.S. conduits, proxies, to provide both money and ideological infrastructure to radicalize young Islamic men, primarily in Afghanistan, but obviously more broadly.
Yes. Are we talking Mujahideen here?
Yeah, the Mujahideen, that's right. Yeah. Which gave rise to Al-Qaeda later on. This was created out of a U.S. Government-run policy under Operation Cyclone. And again, it wasn't done directly without proxies. This is where Saudi Arabia became a useful aspect to this. But Saudi Arabia itself is a bit more rich in its structure than a lot of people realize. They oversimplify it because it, it has acted like a U.S. proxy or an Anglo-Zionist proxy for a number of decades, that they think of it somewhat as like, that's all it is. And that's what I often thought too for many years. I had a very simplistic idea, and I've come to appreciate a bit more the richer context. Yes. I mean, you had like King Faisal in 1976 assassinated.
Yes.
Right. There were a variety of defecting Saudi princes who were friends with Gamal Abdel Nasser of Egypt, yeah, and were friends of the pan Arabian pro-development paradigm that Nasser had represented against empire and forward development of sovereign nation states, based on a unification and a harmonization of the various national groupings of the Arab world together under some higher strategy. So you had a lot of princes from Saudi Arabia. Also, I was reading this book recently called, it's from this 1978, called Saudi Arabia, Rush to Development. And it's an interesting book from this like late 70s, going through what should have been Saudi Arabia's destiny had these groupings remained in power. Unfortunately, the Kissinger faction won the day and they were all purged,
yeah,
which was to create a massive industrial mobilization in Saudi Arabia based on nuclear power. Even though they had a lot of oil, they were still going, they understood nuclear power is the only way to get true energy sovereignty. That was the orientation. A lot of countries were doing that. Pakistan was doing it under Bhutto, who was also killed by a program run by Kissinger in 79. So you have all of these leaders who wanted to follow what was known then as the Japanese model of massive technological industrial development to become economically sovereign, not just politically, but Kissinger, the Trilateral Commission of Zbigniew Brzezinski that were doing what I was just alluding to before, they had a different view. And they said, no, there's going to be one game in town. It's going to be the hegemon, the Anglo-American axis that will determine the rules of the global game. We have to first destroy whatever's on the other side of the Iron Curtain. Well, that's where there's a variety of techniques, but Afghanistan was a big one there.
Yeah.
And Saudi Arabia will be a big part of the equation, both to fund the radicalization of Islamic young people,
yep,
but then also to be the basis of the petrodollar.
Yes.
And so Saudi Arabia's aspirations to have a full spectrum economy had to be thrown in the garbage, and in favor, Saudi Arabia had to commit to a deal with the devil, saying you will only do oil that will then be priced on the global spot markets, where all transactions will only be done in US dollars. We'll protect you militarily, but you're not going to have any upstream or downstream economy the way you wanted to in Saudi Arabia or UAE. So no industries, no manufacturing, no ability to refine or produce the things that otherwise should be a part of a
healthy economy. It's one of those, we'll control you, but we'll protect you at the same time.
We'll enrich a local elite. Yeah.
I was just thinking back of a time when I'd love experience in London, pubs, clubs, nightclubs, it goes on. I don't know, it was a place in North London which was a Muslim, it wasn't a church, it was more of a meeting place, but it was in North London. And we was doing all the ceilings in it, I had it on like a price. And when I was there, I found out that I think they received 2 or 3 million from the National Lottery. Now, there's a couple of things with this. Is one, when I was down the Thames, there was a guy saying, oh, look at that, that's lovely, that's 30 million there. That was saying to do with an opera house. Same again, it was National Lottery. The money that they get, it just makes me wonder if it's something to do with, obviously, the East, as in Israel. But this was years ago. This was about 20 years ago. But it was a case that people paid £1, now it's £2 or whatever it is. I don't use it.
Yeah,
but
it's one of those. I think I know what you're getting at. For me, the lottery is just a tax on hope. It's one of those. Exactly. I'd like to be rich. I'd like to take £2.50 off you. Matthew, Eric, you see all these, shall we say, wonderful things that are meant to enrich people's lives. This is just when this money is sort of being floated around London. London now is sort of like the epicenter of all this global banking and everything else. We're seeing Saudi money being sort of put through there, various things like this, just to keep the masses happy, aren't they? Well, they get on with the system of running your lives.
Yeah, sure. It's pacification. They have to make people as docile and passive as possible. Well, yeah, they rape you. I mean, absolutely. Yes. It's the old blood and circus, or the blood. Yeah. Blood, wine and circus, right.
Yes.
Of the old Roman Empire. And, the old technique does work, but the thing I was trying to lead up to, and I think is just an important thing to keep in mind, is that I've observed that a lot of those power players, especially the figure of Prince Bandar bin Sultan, who was a very close friend of now King Charles,
yes.
They studied together, they're friends together. He was known as Bandar Bush because he was very close to the Bush family going back to the 80s. He oversaw the Yamama deal, the Dove deal.
The arms deal.
Yes.
Yeah, the BAE, we'll give you a tanker of oil, you give us weapons, and we'll sell a lot of that oil on the spot markets. We'll have black budget that'll like build up into funding all of these terrorist operations international. So that was done now for like 25 years or so, as far as what maintained, or a big part of what maintained things like 9/11, funded 9/11 as an aspect of an inside job, as well as other inside jobs in Britain were funded through the type of covert structure and paramilitary organization that was paid for by this thing. But Prince Bandar has been purged. So since 2017, we've begun seeing real evidence of a major fight within Saudi Arabia between a faction that would like to go back to this policy doctrine that Kissinger canceled in the mid-70s, and the old faction that would like to remain loyal to the Anglo-American hegemon as jurisdictional managers of the Middle East, as they were promised that they would be under the New World Order with their Wahhabite sort of thing. So there is evidence of a massive fight against the Saudi deep state. We've had Prince Bandar purged. We've had a whole slew. It's like looking at the list of Russian oligarchs who have been purged under Putin. Similar things have been going on under MBS. So I think that there's still residues of the what was created since the 70s, especially inside of the financing of radicalizing mosques in England itself, but also in the United States or in Canada. There's still residuals of a lot of that stuff that are still problematic, but there is a shift towards breaking free of that with Saudi Arabia, UAE joining the BRICS, with Iran, with Egypt, with Ethiopia as well, who have been trying to sort of liberate themselves from that type of formula for control. So that's positive. That's a positive thing. Unfortunately, here living in, I'm in Canada, British Commonwealth country, you guys part of the Commonwealth, not so easy to see some of that more optimistic stuff since we're run by the death cult. So,
yes.
Matthew, I was going to you just half answered the question I was going to ask. But, you know, Brzezinski and Kissinger, you know, they're a pair, aren't they? They're like the 70s and 80s version of Newland, but you know, they tip up in your country and there's trouble. So with that grouping, that faction that wanted to develop Saudi Arabia in the Middle East and then being removed, I was going to run up to the question, you know, is that a reflection of their movement into BRICS, which you're basically saying is yes, that's part of it. That's part of their development. And one of the factions wants to go that way. Equally, that sort of opens up the question, the BRICS replacing the West, and the globalists, as represented by Kissinger and Brzezinski in this scenario, the collapse, World War III, the civil wars caused by, you know, mass migration into the West, and, you know, then parking, working off onto the vaccines and to the climate hoax as well. The collapse of the West now seems central to all of these same players, not Brzezinski and Kissinger, because they've been and gone, but those that supersede them, the Klaus Schwabs of this world. So how do you see what's going on in the Middle East and the BRICS against contrasting with the current direction of the West? And can the West's collapse be avoided?
Yeah, it can be avoided, but we have to kind of merit avoiding it. Like, we have to, it's going to take some effort to take some heads out of asses before that we deserve to avoid our fate, because we've kind of like, embraced through an acceptance of stupidification and folly and corruption for many decades. We've embraced this. We tolerated it. We allowed it. So it's kind of on us now to face the consequences of that, unless we can wisen up, which has happened historically now and again, before the Dark Age really hits. But I think that the original formula for the economic coup led by the Trilateral Commission in the early 70s was to blow out the system. So they wanted to take what was formerly a viable industrial economic order with problems, big problems, but it was still viable, and turn it into a time bomb by transforming our very concepts of what is profit, what is the role of money, what is the role of government and economy. All of that was transformed under Kissinger and George Shultz, who floated the dollar onto the floating exchange rate, right?
He did.
And then tied it to the price of oil through the petrodollar, and increasingly debts, unbounded debts, disconnected from any type of metric of real world industrial index or productivity. That was all removed. So formally, when money was growing in circulation in the 50s or 60s, whether in Canada or Europe or Britain or here in the US, you could generally say it is a justified increase of money in circulation because the industrial index of measurable goods that were still tied to the GDP was measurably growing agro-industrially or whatever.
Yes.
After the 71 period, that was severed. And so people became stupider, looking only myopically at increasing profits based on speculation instead of creation or real investment.
Yeah.
And so that was done. Those who oversaw top down that coup understood that what they did. They didn't believe in making money with fake debts. They believed that would make people stupid and it would turn our economy into a time bomb that could then be detonated with everybody tied under the US
the same dollar. Umbrella.
Yeah, the same umbrella. I don't believe that they anticipated what has come about, which was that a bunch of those countries that were supposed to be in the same building that was to be detonated would leave the building
before the bomb went off.
Yeah.
Matthew, would you say the fractional reserve system when that came in? Because obviously that is a system that is mired in debt. And of course, they make it very difficult for the average person to understand. And I had to read Modern Money Mechanics and very quickly worked out that this system is just based on debt, isn't it? So this was always going to be the case once they collapsed the basically got control of the banks in the Wall Street crash.
Always, but at the same time, look, the fractional reserve as a topic has been highly overgeneralized and oversimplified because there is a viable way of creating anti-inflationary debts utilizing what appears to be a fractional reserve practice, but not really. So going back to the 18th century or 19th century big time, or even 18th century, you could look at examples of that, even in the 1640s under Colbertism in France. There was the idea that was innovated by Colbert. Jean-Baptiste Colbert was the finance minister of France, who oversaw a lot of major infrastructure and hard soft, right? Education, as well as canal building, universities, water systems, sanitation. So a lot of manufacturing, the application of technologies into manufacturing was done under Colbert's watch. And his work on political economy was taken up by Benjamin Franklin, by a lot of the founding fathers who brought this into the Republic. And the idea was that you could create certain types of debt that you wouldn't need to necessarily have a dollar-to-dollar ratio within the bank that would give out a loan to a company. If the company was doing something that was going to produce much greater profits that would extinguish the debt, but in time, right? It would take maybe 3 to 8 years. So the banks would be able to have less reserves than what they were lending out if it was done under this type of competent banking where you're building the real economy. And that was fine because you're now creating more free energy. It's credit. It's productive credit that's tied to future productivity, which will not get you in more debt. Whereas the usurious, like Rothschild oriented, fractional reserve idea that really came in badly with the Federal Reserve, that type of fiat was based on the intention of creating debt slavery. So always create greater rates of debt without while sabotaging your means of paying off even those little debts that you took out originally, always making more debt happen at compound interest on top of them. And then you're going to bundle them, securitize them, and then speculate on them, creating even more nominal assets in the banking system that have even less value but are hyperinflationary on top of it. So it's a different intention. But yeah.
It is one of those, though, isn't it, that this Adams was the one who actually turned around and said that allowing a central bank is probably would be the death of America, and it shouldn't be allowed to happen. Did the people at that time fall asleep at the wheel, or did they buy into it, Matthew?
It was always the nature of what the central bank was going to be. I'm not against a central bank. If it's a national central bank, I see it as being okay. It's just that when it's a private central bank operating outside of the constitution of the nation, then you have a problem. So in the case of the United States, I think that there has been a tradition, like Abraham Lincoln's greenbacks were done as a central banking practice, in a sense, where they nationalized the bank, but they didn't get the full central bank, but they created a national banking complex with U.S. treasuries that would then be the basis that would be purchased either by the people through 520 bonds, or that would be invested in by whatever banks that wanted to operate with a license had to put a certain amount of their own bank assets into the national banking system that would then justify the emission of monetized currencies into the system. But that would then be tied to building things like the Transcontinental Railway, a lot of big projects, giving loans to productive enterprises to do things that they had to justify. That was fine. And that was used on the template of constitutional banking that had been outlined by John Jay, Alexander Hamilton earlier, who created a national bank they allowed for private investors into the bank, but the bank itself had to be the majority owner had to be the government, and the people on the board of the bank had to live in the states where the national bank had outlets. They couldn't be outside of the US, they couldn't be outside of the state. So it had a mandate that was tied to the moral well-being of the people and the nation as a whole, which that's what John Adams didn't understand. I think John Adams was confused about that, as was Madison and Jefferson. But they woke up to it a little bit later during the war against Great Britain in 1812, when Madison, who was against the bank, realized, without having a central bank, we're going to die. We're going to be destroyed by Great Britain. And he had to then create the bank again to carry out the war. Otherwise, the U.S. was done for, finished.
And that mirrors the creation of the Bank of England with the Royal Navy and the expansion of power, or the projection of power. But we look today, or I look today, and I think, they were right. You know, the central banks are destroying the West, both at a financial level and at a societal level.
Absolutely. But again, if it's like you look at the battle around the Bank of England, and I wrote a chapter on this in my Anglo-Venetian Roots of the Deep State book that I did. And there's a chapter.
Is that the one you published on LinkedIn? Or something on LinkedIn?
I don't know. I it's all over my Canadian Patriot website, this book. But the chapter is on the origins of the Bank of England. And the one point that really popped out at me is that though the Bank of England was modeled on the Private Bank of Amsterdam, which itself was modeled on a Venetian bank of the Levant earlier on. So these are all private banks that sort of migrated with the oligarchy's takeover of first Denmark, of the Netherlands, and then England through the Glorious Revolution, where they transplanted their Dutch system, which was a Venetian system, into England, where England became now the proxy that would be used to create a global new Roman Empire under some pagan Gnosticism, masquerading maybe as Christian, but it was actually Hellfire Club. And the battle against it was run by Sir Robert Harley, the prime minister, who became a very close advisor to Queen Anne. And he had allies with Jonathan Swift, with Daniel Defoe, the literary figures, advisors, who formulated the National Land Bank in 1796. And the National Land Bank was supposed to undo the Bank of England that was created 2 years earlier. And the National Land Bank, when you read Daniel Defoe's outline of how it was going to work, what the idea of value was, who was going to administer it, it was much more like a Hamiltonian national bank that would be tied to emitting credit for building canals, training orphans, building up a military, like doing things that were in the national interest and not for an empire. But that was then destroyed especially in 1710, when, you know, Queen Anne dies. Well, she dies in 1714, but Robert Harley is ousted. His whole like nationalist grouping in England is purged by this time. And the Churchill faction, like Lord Marlborough, takes control fully. They were called the Venetian Party. The Cavendishes were big ones in that whole takeover. And then from there, they turned the National Land Bank into the South Sea Company. And the South Sea Company became the driving force of the South Sea Bubble. And the bubble was what was sort of like a prototype for what was later done in the United States in the Great Depression.
Reflecting a mirroring of activity. Every time there's a successful grouping of nationalists who want to develop and create and improve and grow, these globalists come in, sweep it all away, purge people, and then go back to the big plan.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's always the formula.
Matthew, the South Sea Company, obviously, it was the governor of the merchants of Great Britain, I believe, and they were trading to other parts, weren't they? It was a joint stock company.
Created as a
public-private partnership to consolidate and I suppose in some ways reduce national debt, wasn't it, at the start?
It was always done to create a bubble based on the promises of riches that would be found in the South Sea and all sorts of, you know, infinite gold. But they were always based on lies, and it was designed for those in the know who were making the lies. They knew, like the insiders of JP Morgan who were setting up the bubbles of the 1920s, that they knew were going to be detonated as they were then able to sell their stocks before they detonated their own bubble. And then they made a profit and then were able to buy up the real estate, the assets, all of the houses that dumb investors lost when they were gambling, trying to make money with money, like the tulip bubble earlier in Amsterdam.
Because 2008, also. Matthew, in 2008, the banking bubble that happened then, did they know that was the housing bubble that collapsed then and everybody? Was that all planned?
Yep. I think so. I think Alan Greenspan knew exactly what he was doing. He followed the formula. That's always had the same effect. And Alan Greenspan is a Trilateral Commission devotee. Yes, he's part of the inner club. Yep. So I think he's not stupid, but he did things that only a stupid person would do in his position, which was to artificially jack up lower the interest rates to such a point on real estate and allow such unbounded subprime investments that would undoubtedly just create what exactly happened.
Just for other people out there listening, basically what they were doing was they were giving mortgages to people that were very, very risky indeed, and then turning around and saying these were absolutely golden.
Yeah, and it was done at the same time that he oversaw the deregulation of derivatives in 2001. He oversaw the destruction of Glass-Steagall. So these things had to be done systematically. You had to destroy Glass-Steagall, the separation of investment from commercial banking. That had to be destroyed under Clinton, last act in office, and Alan Greenspan oversaw that. Then you had to deregulate the derivatives, which he did in 2001, to allow now unbounded speculation of something that was already getting out of control. And then with all of that, you could take all of these securitized bundles of subprime mortgages and the film Inside Job. It's a good movie that goes through this in a very intelligible way. It was then very clear how that was going to create a momentary upsurge in profits for gamblers, but it was going to be naturally something that would only blow up in your face, and the insiders would then be able to do a wealth transfer, kind of like what they did on a bigger scale now 15 years later is what's underway.
This is the same thing has been done. If we talk about COVID for a bit, the same thing has been done with regard to separation of powers with changing law to enable, you know, because I think the original protection for vaccine manufacturers was for children, and they needed to law in order to extend that, and that's why they used the anthrax scare or the anthrax outbreak on the US military so that they could turn around and extend that protection to the companies for adults as well. That allowed them to then bring the COVID gain of function research and the vaccines that stem from it. That allowed the government under Trump, but previously under Obama, which is also linked to the CARE Act, Obamacare, I forgot what it's called, and that enabled them to actually change the laws of separation, the laws that protected the public, and allowed them to roll out these vaccines that weren't vaccines and get away with calling them vaccines and change the definition of them as well. It was the same process that you've just described in the banking world 50, 60 years earlier that they did again through the 90s and the noughties to facilitate COVID or the vaccines.
Dude, you said it very well, Lee. Yeah. And I would also add one thing, too, with Obamacare, on top of what you just said, there is also the element of introducing quality adjusted life years as being an economic model for best practices in distributing what we were told was ever limiting or ever reducing resources of medical supplies that we were told is the inevitable fate of that we have to adapt to, is how to live with less. And that was part of the equation where they really want to get to killing off old people with mass euthanasia, as well as young people and pretty much anybody who's a useless eater. They want to have
limits to growth.
Yeah, limits. Well, yeah, and they want to have these unelected expert anonymous panels. This is the death panel thing that was actually there and is there with Obamacare, is our panels of experts that would utilize computer modeling to determine who gets what resource in a limiting supply based upon some imaginary dollar value for each year of their life. So if you're like a 25-year-old worker who's in good health, one year of your life,
we'll look after you.
Might be worth, $190,000. But if you're like a 63-year-old guy, you've already worked your life, you've paid your taxes, your kidney transplant will not be paid for. They'll pay maybe a painkiller and a euthanasia pill for you.
Four quarters and a painkiller. Nihlis wants to ask you a question.
Nihlis. Just before Nihlis, I heard this likened to the, what's that movie? I forgot what it's called now.
Soylent Green.
Soylent Green's one, and then Logan's Run. The Logan's Run mentality, where you get to 30 and then you become useless to the establishment.
That's predictive programming movies. That's what they're constantly trying to put into our psyche to get us to adapt to these types of unnatural dystopian outcomes that they always wanted to have. Going back to the 70s takeover by the Trilateral Commission, they've always wanted that as something we would adapt to instead of resist morally as a normal human would if that wasn't being embedded into our psyche. But yeah, absolutely.
Nihlis, you wanted to ask a question before you were...
Well, I wanted to ask Matthew. They said that we're very near a new financial collapse. What do you think the bankers were trying to take out of that? Because they seem to have everything in terms of multinationals. You said before, when something collapsed, they would take people's houses who lost their investments. And what do you think they'll take out of the next collapse?
Everything else.
Yeah, I mean, you already see it with BlackRock and Vanguard and State Street being positioned to own so much commercial and normal real estate that they're already in the middle of massively buying up with dollars that are essentially monopoly money. However, there's a lot of stock selling going on right now amongst insiders in the know who are kind of purging some of their assets to try to like turn it in, because they're buying islands. You know, Jeff Bezos is buying islands.
Obviously Mark Zuckerberg's building islands, not only getting an island, but getting bunkers.
$400 million worth.
I wanted to ask you something while we're talking on that. Because obviously, and of course, Matthew, you're completely right. It is one of those, you'll own nothing and be happy. But Matthew, when we talk about all the things that are going on in the world like this, and while we're talking on banking, CDBCs, your thoughts on this? Central Digital Banking Currency. Central Bank Digital Currency.
Yes.
This is the final knock of your freedom, isn't it?
Well, it's that is what they want to do is 1923 Germany, you know, Weimar. So they want to blow out the Weimar economy by getting idiots to just money print and not develop the real economy. Because there were people like Wilhelm von Lautenbach, as well as there was a network of Germans who were industrialists in the early 20s. Who had a program like the Saudis did in the 70s to deal with the Versailles Treaty by creating massive investment into the real economy. They were working also with some Russians who had just taken power to cancel all of the German debts to Russia and reset the Versailles debt. That was called the Rapallo Accords of 1922. Now, most of those people got killed by paramilitary groups that were created and run by London, by British intelligence, like the organization Consul that had a huge outlet inside of Germany that then became, after killing like 300 German leaders in between 1921 and 1924, they were illegalized and then were rebranded to become the Nazi paramilitary organization that was working with Hitler to advance the redignification of Germany after its embarrassment under this Wall Street London broker.
Hugo Stinnes.
Parallels.
Hang on, two secs. Hugo Stinnes was one of those, wasn't it? Because he suddenly died in 1924. And he was one of those sort of industrialists, one of those people who was going to get Germany back on its feet.
There was a lot. Yeah, I'm forgetting the names of, I used to have more of a record in my memory banks, but I've written, they do come up in chapter 3 and 4 of my Clash of the Two Americas volume 2 book, some of the personalities. Anyway, and I would say that the solution for that Hjalmar Schacht, who was a stooge of Montague Norman, brought in was, okay, bring us your wheelbarrows full of hyperinflated Reichsmarks, and we'll trade you for these new shiny Rentenmarks that you can give us, like $100 trillion Reichsmarks, and we'll give you one new Rentenmark, and it would now be associated with a new set of rules of behavior that would then shut down, like, I mean, they purged the civil service, social programs, everything was cut. Things were privatized under this weird corporate nationalism merger thing under that became Hitler. The dollar was devalued, or the Reichsmark was devalued. All that to say, that solution was done by design by first creating the hyperinflated blowout. And that's sort of what they've been trying to prepare for now, which is to blow out our economies of the world, and then introduce the solution, which would be a new CBDC type of a currency associated with credits tied to behavior, which would be in accommodation with a death cult that wants us to eat bugs, drink less water, eat less food, move less as far as using gasoline, and then just shut down our metabolism as a species so that we're being rewarded financially through these fake digital assets. Yes. They're nothing. They don't exist. As we shut down our ability to exist. And that's what they want. So, but at the same time as I say that, there's a big battle over what these things are. So if you look at the BRICS, they're also talking about digital currencies and things like that. However, the paradigm of what is the behavior of money, its relationship to people, value, is completely different. Where there you have a focus on rewarding people for doing abundance, for building more infrastructure, for producing more food, for doing things that make life better, because there is going to be a new economy, and it's going to have a lot. It will be associated with some form of blockchain, some form of digital assets of some sort. But will it be tied to a death cult valuation system that wants to depopulate and kill us under a hereditary elite? Or will it be based upon national economies working to increase their industrial productive power to support more life? That's the question. That's the fight right now that I see it between these two systems vying for influence.
I'll let Lee jump in here, but I do want to come back to that because I've got another question on it.
Well, I'm interested in the parallels here with what's gone on in Saudi Arabia with the purging, what's gone on previously in the purging of the banking. And now we're talking about Germany and 300 people purged and murdered. And then I look at Robert Fico in Slovakia. I look at the Prime Minister of Georgia, who had a call from the Commissioner for Enlargement from the EU and said, if you don't reverse this law on foreign NGOs, then you might be the next FISO. And then you look at Shinzo Abe, you look at the Brazilian president that was stabbed, Bolsonaro, and then forced out of office. You look at what they've done to Trump. You look at what they've done to several African leaders. I think four during the COVID for not locking down, and it came to a sticky end. You've got the Iranian president that's just crashed into a mountain, even though the other two helicopters with him didn't. And I could go on. So are we witnessing another purge today, politically this time?
I mean, yeah, it's always at these points of a systemic breakdown where the potential for good or for evil increases quite a bit, you know, like people can't really afford to be complacent anymore. So their tendency to want to put out the fire is going to increase. and thus the demands upon political representatives to act according to the will of the people who want to survive during times of crisis is going to be increased quite a bit, and thus we will be expected to see more such things like what you've just described at those moments. We saw a huge wave of assassinations from John F. Kennedy, well, Kwame Nkrumah, Patrice Lumumba before Kennedy, to the South Korea, South Vietnamese leader in 63, 3 weeks later, JFK,
yes.
Martin Luther King Jr. We had Kwame Nkrumah overthrown in a CIA coup. Like internationally, at Mattei from Italy, also who was a big fighter for industrial development of Africa, who was killed in his plane crash. You had the whatever his name was, the UN Secretary General, whose plane also was crashed, who was a yes. friend of African development. So you had a lot of murders going into the 70s. I mentioned King Faisal from Saudi Arabia, yes. but you had
Nasser, you had loads of people said that, obviously. The question I wanted to ask sort of follows on from these, really, because when you take away all that hope, and obviously people are starving and they're queuing up in the streets for bread like they were in 30s Germany, this then allows people to get behind someone who, even if they're a lunatic like Hitler was, who offers hope, who offers some sort of glimmer. Doesn't this allow more lunatics through the door that we're liable then to vote for, because suddenly they've got the golden chalice, you know?
But are these people dangerous, or are they manipulated? Is there manipulation around them? You know, because if people are killing leaders to get these people installed, then they're not beyond manipulating the people around them as well. Look at Truss, what they did to her in 49 days.
Yes, yes. Matthew, do you think this is a case? Could they be leading us down an even darker path?
It's the old formula. The way I see it, I do look at this from a historic standpoint, and it's like the oligarchy tends to control us via controlled oppositions of left and right that manipulate essentially political expressions of the essential aspects of the human condition, which are the emotions and the reason. So that's the fundamental rule of control. If you want to think like an oligarch, the human beings have a coexistence of what appears to be two opposing aspects of life, of being human, which is the thinking rational side that looks for answers to things. It seeks order out of complexity, right? That's what the mind tries to do whenever it looks for the truth behind something confusing. We put puzzles together. Puzzle companies wouldn't make money if you started with a whole puzzle and you just got people to pay money to tear the puzzle apart. That doesn't interest the mind so much as trying to put chaos into order. So that's a natural human thing. It's a beautiful thing. It's what allows for great music and great discoveries in science.
Yes.
At the same time, the emotions are something which could be detached from the mind, and they're very much tied to sensory infinite complexity, right? I'm infinitely receiving through my five senses, infinite stimulation. I'm choosing to give my focus to you guys in this experience.
Yes.
And I'm ignoring all the other things in my room, right, that I could otherwise be giving.
Yeah,
so it's an act of free will. So I'm choosing to focus on these unifying ideas and organize my thoughts. And I'm making, and my feelings are tied to that. But it's how do they work together? Now, in the French Revolution, there was they systematized something that they had already been doing since ancient Babylon, which was the first time you had sort of the dichotomization on the one hand of a left under the Jacobin emotional mobs of poor disenchanted people who had been abused by an aristocracy that had been too cut off from the lower, you know, working class, and these people were rightfully angry. But their emotions were manipulated by rabble rousers like Robespierre to be channeled as a rage mob of
the French Revolution,
the left, proto Bolsheviks, basically. And then on the other hand, you had the reactionary right thus created out of the Girondins, who were the logicians who were reactionary, saying, look, this is what happens when emotions are allowed to run amok.
And we shouldn't have them. Yeah.
Now we'll bring an order and pure logical enlightenment order. And that then created a suffocation of the emotions, and everybody was killing everybody for like a decade. Meanwhile, the real revolutionaries who actually understood what a revolution is all about, which is not about just overthrowing the order. It's about creating a culture of freedom where everybody is given access to their, to cultivate their proper faculties culturally. They were killed. They all had their heads cut off. So the real revolutionaries like Antoine Lavoisier and Jean-Sylvain Bailly and all of the leaders of Benjamin Franklin's Nine Sisters Lodge, which was the active Grand Orient Lodge that was in competition or opposing to the oligarchical control system. That was the Seven Sisters, the Nine Sisters, based on the Nine Greek Muses. Mozart's lodge in Vienna was very much tied to this lodge in France. That was purged. They were all killed.
Yeah.
And all of the Republican lodges were wiped out. And then the solution was, with no qualified moral leadership available, because they'd all been killed mostly, was now Napoleon as a proto-fascist sun king, reviving Napoleon XIV's Mithraic sun cult around some new Freemasonic agency of a global religion. My wife's writing a book on this right now, so I'm just getting briefed.
Yes.
But that was like a proto-fascist. That's what they were doing. They did that again with the Bolsheviks. That would then create a natural reactionary response with the right wing.
Yes.
Oswald Mosley, Hitler, Mussolini, you know, red shirts, black shirts, brown shirts, response to this hyper right left-wing mass mob thing. And both were wrong. Both were controlled to create a higher synthesis of technocratic feudalism. Yes. So that's what's being done again today. And I do see a very big danger of a lot of people who typically like the type of messaging that's going on here, like that we're talking about. A lot of people who follow my stuff, I'm seeing a huge, in the last year and a half especially, a huge increase of pro-Hitler narratives, where people are starting to really, really romanticize. They're watching Europa, produced by the way, you guys have seen Europa?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, that thing's produced by a bunch of Banderite Nazis.
It is,
People get brainwashed and they're coming out loving Hitler now, who also are like, if you want to fight the Great Reset, we have to revive Hitler. And it's like, whoa.
Steady on there. I must admit, I looked at it and I was absolutely horrified. I sort of want to just backtrack a little there, because is that what then, you know, when we talk about the Illuminati or the people who are really meant to bring so-called light and science into the world, is that the sort of thing that...
It's the opposite of what they want.
Yeah, exactly. Or are they what everybody else says, a force for evil, in your opinion?
The Illuminati?
Are they the light bringers, or are they a force for evil, in your opinion?
I mean, the whole Illuminati discussion is so enmeshed with misinformation at this point that I don't even like.
Can you unravel it?
I've unraveled some things. Like, I know that some of the biggest tropes about the Illuminati that were like extolled by Winston Churchill or Nesta Webster, who was also a high-level theosophical Luciferian occultist,
who
was trying to like reframe how good British patriots should look at their history as a battle between Jewish Freemasonry tied to the continental Freemasonry, Satan one, but the good Freemasonry is the United Grand Lodge of England, where the good guys are. And it's like the Illuminati are somehow playing a bad guy role in this whole like crafting of a narrative that she's spinning, with Churchill promoting it as well. And, you know, and so I've looked at some of the details upon which the foundation, like these narrative structures are built, and there's a lot of holes in them. Like the oligarchical death cult agency of the Hellfire Club existed well before the thing called the Illuminati ever came to be.
Yes.
That's where I try to like get people to understand, well, what is the Hellfire Club? How is this a revival of the ancient Gnostic mystery religions?
Yes. It wasn't called the Hellfire Club for nothing.
Yeah, you know, it's not just a play on words. That's real. And they're reviving really the ancient Isis mystery cults, mysteries that were tied to the Lucinian mysteries, the ancient order of priesthood controls pre-Christian era that was being revived by the Hellfire Club. And you can prove it. You can prove that. And the whole like storyline around Adam Weishaupt, the Jesuit Freemason, who we know about because somebody carrying letters between Weishaupt and one of his commanders or whatever got zapped by lightning, and some peasant found his bag of mail and unraveled all of these letters showcasing and revealing to the world what is the Illuminati. And I mean, that whole story is so contrived. Like, that doesn't happen. Like, where somebody's just like walking with a bag of letters, they get hit by lightning and a peasant finds it, and all of a sudden we know this whole story. No, they made that up. That's a fake story that they made up to give it to us.
That wouldn't be anything like the Bible, Matthew, would it? Lee Williams wants to ask you a question.
This is just a question to Matthew. I like my holidays now, and I've been to Butlins, and I've been to, you know, Bognor Regis. It's really nice. You know, the English gentlemen know that. Have you ever been to Rothschild in Antarctica? It's just below, I feel it's just below Argentina.
It's a place called Rothschild in Antarctica?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a conspiracy. So what you do is you go onto Google and you type Rothschild and Antarctica, and it'll show you it's just south from Argentina. And we weren't allowed to go on holiday. You know, it didn't matter to me because I weren't born then, but that was 1959, if I imagine.
Wow. I'm Googling it now. I find it interesting. Yeah. Rothschild Island. Island.
It's
right there, eh?
It's
pretty far down from Argentina. It's really far down, but it's still on the on the coast of Antarctica for sure.
Yeah.
I'll look into it. I never heard of that.
It's in Antarctica.
Yeah, it's in the Desko Mountains, isn't it? If I remember right, I think that's where it is. Desko Mountains, I think, Matthew.
The island was first sighted in 1825 by this dude, a German guy, who described three peaks, and it was then named Rothschild Island.
Is it the Desko Mountains? Sure.
Huh?
I think it's around the Desko Mountains, I think.
All you got to do is go onto the map of Google or whatever and just put Rothschild Antarctica on it, and it'll show you the...
Yeah, I'm on Wikipedia now. Yeah.
Matthew, we're starting to run out of time. Where can people find you on your social media, buddy?
Oh, yeah. I should memorize these things. Telegram, I keep up more than other social media things I do. Yeah. So Telegram, if you have Telegram, it's t.me/Canadian Patriot Press. Otherwise, I am on Twitter and I am on LinkedIn and things, but I don't remember how to find me on those. My websites are pretty good, though. If you want to find me on MatthewErritt.substack.com, I update that almost every day for subscribers. Yep. Most of it's free. Also, CanadianPatriot.org has all sorts of global stuff, history stuff. And lastly, I'll say RisingTideFoundation.net has a lot of cultural, educational stuff that I do with my wife. And all of my books, if people want to pick up the books, I've written a lot on the untold history of Canada, the clash of the two Americas. There's a multi-volumes of each one, and those are easy to find on CanadianPatriot.org.
Yes, absolutely. Lee, we never leave without a funny. Dear boy, could you pull up our Boeing fun fact? You've got a picture there of our Boeing. I don't know whether you've heard about this, Matthew, but the Boeing planes have been falling out of the sky and doors falling off and everything else. And, of course, they've turned around and said it's safe. Well, it's going to be perfectly okay because Boeing jets are going to come out as trans-safe, which means they're safe. They're not safe, but they identify as safe. there we go. There's nothing wrong with Boeing. You can climb on one. It is one of those, Matthew, isn't it, where they've split the company of Boeing down to the point where it's putting passenger safety at large. And as a world at large, we will trade people's safety for profit.
It's not a new thing, eh? It's not a new thing.
No, it's not a new thing. I can't thank you for joining us enough today. It's been absolutely brilliant to have you here. I hope you'll come back and
see
us.
You again.
Yeah,
likewise, man. Just say the word. I'll happily join once again in the future. Yeah. Just say the word.
It is one of them. Thank you so much for being with us, Matthew, and take care. Right.
Bye, gents.
All right, bye-bye. Thank you.
Any further questions just before we go, gentlemen? Lee, Nilis, Barry, Tom, anything you want to ask?
It would have been nice if I could have asked him, but obviously it's time. I didn't get home from work about an hour ago. Yeah. Basically, I was going to ask him, does he know any sheriffs? Because there's a situation with the corporation of, you know, what's really bad, but then there's people actually supporting the actual people, and the actual elites are getting scared of it now. But that's in Canada, you got it in America, obviously Europe. It's a law that was brought out, like I say, last year. But
yeah,
there's not many. There's only one sheriff I know, which is Yvonne. She comes from America, and but it's much interesting.
We'll have a look into that, buddy. But he's probably probably googling the Rothschilds in Antarctica at the moment. One of them. been absolutely brilliant. I think you sort of it is. I'm pretty sure it's around those mountains because I remember hearing about it when we were traveling.
It's an island off the coast, isn't it? So that yes. only be in mountains. One thing I would like to say.
There is mountains.
Yeah, well, one thing I would like to say, Matthew has just spent the best part of half an hour talking about economics, and you never complained once.
But what he had to say was quite staggering, wasn't it?
Yeah, he's brilliant. I was going to say, yeah. I couldn't wait to get him on the show.
Yes. He's one of those. Yeah.
He's like me. He can link all these things together. But
thank you very much. Thank you very much, Mr. Lee. Mr. Lee, I'm going to pull you up here.
If you let me finish, you would have been included as well.
Yeah, no, you can finish, but I'm just going to pull you up there because you said there's no mountains. There are. The Desko Mountains are on Rothschild Island.
Also, I don't know a lot. Is there pyramids in Antarctica as well?
I believe so, but they're not proven yet.
No.
Believe so, but they haven't proven it yet.
It's one of those.
They won't let anybody go there, will they?
No. Not since 1959.
I'll tell you what, I'm normally bored to tears by finance, and a few people dropped off of the show today, obviously, over their heads or not really interested in finance. But I will say this, it's a lot better than watching England play football.
Change the shape of the ball, the game will...
It's not the change of shape of the ball. We need to change the manager. Is absolutely.
I'll tell you something. I know a couple of professional rugby players, and they're genuine people. That is the one thing. They're genuine. You know.
Yeah. Well, you don't get a face like this without playing rugby for 25 years.
Well, it's one of them footballer gets even touched and they roll around. I do remember the great Nigel Owens turning around and saying to the Scottish fullback, he actually turned around and said, he never touched you and you behave like that. Come back here in 2 weeks' time and play. He said, you don't do it on my rugby. Well, and he was.
Well, you know what they say? Football, 90 minutes of people pretending that they're hurt. Rugby, 80 minutes of people pretending that they're not hurt.
Yeah, exactly that. Thank you so much for being here. We've run out of time. It's been absolutely brilliant, and our thanks to Matthew Eric, obviously. And sometimes the subjects aren't for everybody, and that's absolutely fine. But what we will do is get interesting people on and give those who want to see stuff and learn stuff all sorts of chances to do so. If it wasn't your cup of tea, apologies, but then again, the next one might be your cup of tea and nobody else's.
One thing I would add, Warren, is if get someone like Matthew talks, again, he's so interesting, if you can't get your hint in to put your hand up, you can always type your question in the chat and we'll pick it up and we'll get it to him.
Yeah, no problem at all. Thank you very much. It is time for us to go. So, as I say, we've run out of time. So it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from him.
Goodbye.